From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour today, I talk with a man who for the past 32 years has fielded complaints from people who are dissatisfied with state and local government, retiring state ombudsman Bill Angrick. He'll tell us about some of the most serious issues lawmakers face as he leaves the position. Then, Rolling Stone contributing editor David Lipsky will talk about his new biography of author David Foster Wallace, the brilliant writer and MacArthur genius who committed suicide in 2008. Lipsky will speak at the Des Moines Public Library on Friday evening. That's all coming up this hour, right after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My first guest today is the man who, for the past 32 years, has fielded complaints from people who are dissatisfied with state and local government. Bill Angrick is the state ombudsman, and he is retiring soon. Although Bill Angrick's last day won't be until June, we've invited him on the program to share his reflections on his more than three decades of work and his concerns as he prepares to leave the office. Bill Angrick joins us by phone from the office of the state ombudsman in Des Moines. Good afternoon to you, Bill.
Hello there, Ben.
Remind us, for those of us who need a reminder, what is the job of the state ombudsman?
Well, the Citizens Aid or Ombudsman for the state of Iowa is an official of the Iowa legislature, and our office is charged to receive and investigate and report on complaints citizens have about Iowa state and local government. We deal with issues of whether the agencies follow the law or the rule of or policies, whether they were unfair or unreasonable in their application of their authority or powers, whether things are based on error fact or there's some other motivating variable that should not be involved in the delivery of governmental services. It's a wide range jurisdiction and authority.
Mm-hmm. So how many people do you work with in your office?
Including myself, I have a staff of, the staff is 16. I have 15 people who work for me.
How many complaints reach your office in a week or in a year? How do you measure that?
We measure it by the year, and it is just shy of about 5,000 each year.
5,000 complaints, and who files them? Average citizens mostly?
Average citizens generally make up a significant portion of our complaint load. We have specific responsibilities to entertain complaints from individuals in Iowa's jails and prisoners and prisons. They make up about 20% of our caseload each year, but individuals who have complaints about the Department of Human Services, the programs there, child abuse, other child care programs, child support recovery, taxes, driver's license issues, local zoning issues, police issues. The gamut is wide.
So all types of complaints. And the people who make the complaints are reaching you by email, by phone, how?
Approximately 75% of our cases come in by telephone. We have an 800 number. But email, obviously, over the last many years has started to increase in terms of the proportion of contact that we have. Letters, still, a lot of people write letters. We get letters usually half a dozen a day, and people can also walk into our office.
Okay. Let's take a hypothetical situation just so you can demonstrate what happens to a complaint. I get a parking ticket, and I go to my local authority, and I'm still not satisfied that they won't release me from this parking ticket. I think it's unjust. I contact you. Would that be a plausible hypothetical situation?
Possibly. There, of course, is a defined process that we would expect you to use there. What's the nature of your dissatisfaction? It wasn't your car. Or the meter wasn't expired. The meter was broken.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the variables that we would be asking you to articulate about your complaint.
So when I call you up the first time, I'll get asked the questions that you just asked me.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then
we may ask you, how have you tried to resolve it? And there may be a process where you can appeal initially to the to an administrative office or perhaps to a city council. Usually those, however, are much more defined in the judicial process.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that some of these would be taken care of right in that first stage, answering the phone. You explain this to them, and the person is satisfied or at least realizes that this can't go anywhere.
And there's quite a bit of informal mediation resolution during the initial contact. We have also a lot of discretion in terms of declining initially to take a complaint. Or at least my philosophy has been, I would much rather have the individuals resolve their complaint themselves so that they become a better advocate for themselves than to have a layer of government like the ombudsman to do it for them. So we would ask that they try to resolve the complaint. We would ask them to present us with documentation, if there is documentation. And then we start picking up the telephone or writing letters or emailing to the government official that's being complained about, asking for their side.
Mm-hmm.
Our review is an objective, independent review rather than as an advocate for the aggrieved citizen. Now, as our investigation continues, we may come to the conclusion that the citizen was aggrieved. Then we put on more of an advocate hat, try to get the problem fixed.
Okay, you mentioned the 5,000 complaints about the 5,000 complaints in a year. How many then reach this stage where you're advocating for the person who initially contacted you?
A lot of that depends upon whether we've done a formal or an informal inquiry. Sometimes by just talking to the agency, we find out that there was a misunderstanding or perhaps not all the documentation was presented. And so we facilitate and assist in getting the problem resolved. Other times we believe that the agency was acting appropriately, and we advise the citizen of that. Probably in the neighborhood of 1,200 to have some degree of work toward a resolution or an explanation beyond the initial consideration of the complaint.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a capacity in terms of the numbers of complaints you can handle, and to what extent you can take them? Are you ever overwhelmed, for instance?
Yeah, we can become overwhelmed very quickly, especially if we get complex, highly charged complaints. For example, in the years past, we have investigated the tragic deaths of children in Iowa, and whether the Department of Human Services adequately responded to child abuse allegations. Those require a significant amount of field work, review of documentation, taking of testimony, and you can't, with a small staff of our size, you can't be dealing with many of those at one time. So yes, there is a capacity. We try to prioritize. We try to deal with those that appear to be of significance. Health, safety, basic human rights are those types of issues. Also, if we perceive that there's a systemic pattern of a certain type of complaint, that might move it up the priority list for us.
Mm. Can you point to a complaint in the past that has resulted in a systemic recognition of a systemic problem that eventually resulted in perhaps a policy change in a department in one of the governmental levels?
Yeah, there are several. In the area of child abuse reporting, we had the tragic death about 10 years ago of a young child, Shelby Dewis, in northwest Iowa. Allegations were that the complaints about the care and treatment she was receiving were not being properly processed by child abuse investigators. And we looked into that rather exhaustively. We made well over a dozen recommendations for various ways of changing that process. And most recently, almost 10 years after the recommendations were made, one of the most critical ones, which we wanted to have, which was centralized intake for all child abuse reports, was agreed to by the new head of the Department of Human Services. He saw it as a cost-saving factor. For a good part of the 10 years, we were having his predecessors argued that it was too costly to do. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is something that will have hopefully dramatic impact on the improving of child protection, child welfare in our state for years to come. Another issue is one of coordination. Again, tragic situation, a young man by the name of Reggie Kelsey apparently committed suicide by jumping off a bridge in Des Moines, again, almost 10 years ago. He was 18 years old at the time. For most of his juvenile life, he was in various types of governmental programs, home placement, group placement. He aged out, in other words, became an adult past the age of 18. The juvenile type of programs and services and coordination were no longer available to him, and there was a disconnect between the transition out of foster care into care for a dependent adult. He fell through the cracks, became homeless, became perhaps depressed, perhaps preyed upon in his homeless capacity, and ended up, according to the official reports, committing suicide. After that, after our investigation, there were changes in the law, changes in public policy that require a greater degree of preparation and coordination when somebody ages out of the foster care system.
What would be one of the most unusual complaints to have crossed your desk in the over 30 years of work?
I don't know. I haven't been prepared for that question.
Don't you? Don't you?
We get some that obviously are off the wall and maybe don't relate to reality. I have somebody who contends that he's the illegitimate son of Buddy Holly.
Really? And what does he want to do about that?
He believes that Buddy Holly was met his fate other than on the airplane. Wants that to be investigated. You know, I consider that to be very unusual, and I think it probably is the individual's fantasy or
Buddy Holly,
lack of context with reality. We will receive many complaints or allegations of a nature that test our ability to decide whether we should even how do you respond to that?
Bill Engrick, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back and give you some more time to think about those unusual complaints that you've received. Bill Engrick with us from Des Moines. He'll soon be retiring as the state ombudsman after more than 32 years of service. I'd like to have you join our conversation. Have you dealt with the state ombudsman? Tell us your story. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll also have Bill talk about his biggest concerns leaving the position, the most serious issues facing the state in his area. That's when The Exchange continues in 1 minute. And we're back with The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, a live telephone conversation with Rolling Stone contributing editor David Lipsky. He has a new biography of the author David Foster Wallace titled Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace. David Lipsky will be speaking in Des Moines this coming Monday. Right now, we're finishing up our conversation with retiring state ombudsman Bill Engrick. Joining us by phone from the state capitol. Bill, as you leave the position, what do you see as the most serious issues facing our state today, areas where you get a lot of complaints and you think perhaps some lawmakers should be doing some things here?
I've identified three recently, but there probably could be at least a half a dozen that I think bear continued attention. First and foremost is I think we need to find a way to better fund and deliver our mental health services across the state. 40 years ago, we opened up the doors on the major mental health institutes, but never followed through with establishing and properly funding local community-based mental health services. Because of that, many individuals fall through the cracks, end up becoming criminalized, and may have initially short stays in jails, but after that perhaps start having longer stays, unable to successfully complete probation, go into prison and become less treated for their mental health concerns and punished. And I would like to see the state address that in the future. It's going to be very, very costly. Another issue which is ongoing is transparency of government and accountability of government. We need to fix, we need to modify our open meetings and public records laws so that they meet the 21st century challenges that are there, especially electronic media and records. But we need to make an actual decision at which time and place that the applicants for important positions in government become known and become public so that the citizens can dialogue with their decision makers about the hiring of a university president or a school board supervisor or superintendent. We need to define what is a draft document and whether those are available, or what is the timeliness of a response? Should we get a record within 10 days?
Would you say in this area, in open records, that Iowa is lagging other states, or do you know how other states are doing here?
It's mixed. It depends upon who the surveyor or the evaluator is. I've seen Iowa get grades of B's and C's, and I've seen them get grades of D's and F's in that. My office handles a great number of these. We have no enforcement authority. The enforcement mechanism is up to the aggrieved party, and that means you need to hire an attorney. Maybe you can recover the costs if you're successful. The legislature was unable to pass create a new agency the last 2 years to make enforcement easier and to fund it as a state agency. So I would say we're probably in the middle. But as long as my office is here, we can and will respond to complaints of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Any other serious issues you haven't mentioned that you think the legislature should address?
Well, the legislature or various agencies, we need to be looking at greater cooperation and coordination between the Board of Parole and the Department of Corrections to ensure that we have gradual release of the offenders in the correction system, to make sure that we don't create barriers for individuals to move through the gradual release steps so that they can prove themselves able to go back into society. There are many, many challenges, and the people who come after me are going to be facing those on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Who takes over for you in your post, or is that not known yet?
Well, my deputy, Ruth Cooperrider, who's been with me for 18 years, by statute, will become acting ombudsman until the legislature decides how it wants to fill the position. Usually in the past, it's been open competition. Of course, for me, that was 32 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Does the current economic problems in our state, across the country, make your job any tougher? Do you notice a difference when the economy is bad?
Well, definitely we get more complaints because government can't do as much as it would like or perhaps should. Revenues are down, which means decisions of a nature have to be made to perhaps reduce services. You may have coming up this major early retirement program for state government is going to cause us to lose a lot of experience. That means, in my mind, I think that you're going to have individuals in positions who are less trained, less experienced. They'll make mistakes. People will be complaining about those or adversely impacted by those. Mm-hmm. Even in our agency, when I looked at the start of 2011, we're going to be $200,000 short. My retirement helps that figure. The retirement of my legal counsel helps that figure. But we're still going to be strapped. We'll have to make decisions on each time that we decide to go out, travel to Iowa City, for example, or to Council Bluffs. Can we afford that, and is it necessary? And my agency is one of many, many, many who are facing those types of decisions in this coming economic year.
So it sounds like because of the cutbacks, Iowans will be less well served by the ombudsman's office necessarily by the cutback.
Well, I think that we will try to find ways to use the discretion and informality to meet the challenges that come to us. And I've got a very dedicated staff, so I think that they will rise to that challenge, but it will be difficult.
Do the politics of the day ever intrude on your work? We have a particularly partisan and a rancorous atmosphere in the last few years.
I would say probably I experienced more pressure politically 30-plus years ago than I experience now. The office is required to be nonpartisan. I think over the years, through many different governors, through many different speakers of the House or presidents of the Senate, they know that I will serve that responsibly. And so I don't think that we necessarily receive political pressure on how to respond to a particular complaint. We do, however, experience the reality of the time, and that is the state government doesn't have enough money.
Mm-hmm. What would have been the politics of the late 70s that would have made it more divisive than it is today?
Not necessarily divisive. It was a new agency, and it was untested, and individuals might think that they would be able to get a favored response or more attention to an issue than we would give if it wasn't somebody in a political position who was calling us.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a lifetime ago for many people.
Right. Now you're in an established office, and people know what you're about. Now, Bill Angrick, what are you going to miss most about leaving the ombudsman's office when that happens in June?
I'll miss my staff and the interplay that we have on how to respond to complaints and how to find solutions to problems. But I'll try to find a way to continue to contribute to Iowa because I think it's important. I think I still have more to give.
Mm-hmm. What are those plans specifically? I don't know if you'd like to share those in your.
I came to this position from Drake University, having been a instructor of political science and public administration. Maybe there's an opportunity for me to find teaching in my future. Definitely will enjoy not only visiting my granddaughters here in the greater Des Moines area, but my grandsons on each of the coasts. So, there's some personal time, and then there'll be some reflection on what can I do and making Iowa a better place. Now, I'm still young. I'm only 64.
Just a few seconds left. What won't you miss at all?
Having to make some of the hard decisions when I wish that we had more resources.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely important to be able to have the safety valve of an ombudsman to hold government accountable. Listening to complaints all the time is not all that welcoming, but it is extremely important. Nobody's ever come to me in 32 years and say, "Hey, Bill, Iowa government's working real well today. Thank you." But it does make a difference when you find somebody who has been treated unfairly and make them whole again. That's a wonderful feeling. You don't know how much that makes you want to handle the next complaint.
Bill Angrick, I want to thank you for this conversation. Congratulations on a long and successful career with the state.
Thank you so much. Take care now.
Take care. Bill Angrick is the retiring, soon-to-retire state ombudsman. In a moment, we'll be back with more of The Exchange. David Lipsky will join us. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. In 1996, David Lipsky of Rolling Stone magazine spent 5 days with the person he would have most wanted to sit down with in the world. David Foster Wallace was clearly America's best young writer at the time. Lipsky said reading Wallace had been for him like hearing for the first time the brain voice of everybody I knew. Here was how we all talked, experienced, thought. It was like smelling the damp in the air, seeing the first flash from a storm a mile away. You knew something gigantic was coming. That something was Infinite Jest, the novel that made Wallace internationally famous. Rolling Stone sent David Lipsky to join Wallace on his book tour's last leg. Years later, in September of 2008, David Foster Wallace committed suicide. Now, David Lipsky's biography of David Foster Wallace, based on that 1996 road trip, has just been published. Its title, Although, of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace, has just jumped to number 16 on the New York Times bestseller list. That after only being released last week. Monday evening, David Lipsky is coming to Des Moines as part of the Des Moines Public Library's AVID author series. David Lipsky joins me this afternoon by phone. Good afternoon, David.
Ben, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Wallace was 34 in 1996 when you took this road trip with him.
He was at the top
of his game. What kind of impression did he make on you when you first met him?
He was terrifyingly brilliant when I first met him, and he didn't seem tremendously happy to see me. So that's sort of a very scary combination.
Was he the man you had expected to meet based on the writing that you admired?
Oh, yeah, he was incredibly brilliant. I mean, one of the great things about doing the book is that I love the way he writes. He's the best writer. I ask listeners to trust me because I read a lot. But he's kind of like the best new writer in the last 20 or 30 years. And the amazing thing about reading the book after I came back from being with David and when we were putting the book together was seeing just how much he spoke the way he wrote. So kind of listening to him talk is more or less like reading another book by him, which for me as a huge fan of his was an incredible bonus.
Mm-hmm. You write, he'd done the thing that was casual and gigantic. He'd captured everybody's brain voice. Tell us what you mean by brain voice.
Well, it's actually David talks about it. He said that that the thing about writing and what really great writing can do that nothing else can do is it jumps up, it kind of jumps over that wall of self, and it connects two brains, and that essentially you get to hear someone else thinking. And there's a voice that I think in, and I'm sure that you think in, and that listeners are thinking in right now, which is just like the way you talk to yourself, and it's a mix of curses and for me from New York, it's mostly curses, and it's a mix of like TV shows or political thoughts or, you know, the soda can we just tripped over or a book we're thinking about, and those things are happening all at the same time, and it's a wonderful kind of mix, and it's a voice we're all very comfortable with hearing from ourselves, but when you read books, it often doesn't sound that way. And so what David really wanted to do most, it's what he talks about in the book, too, was to find some way of making that voice, putting that voice on the page. Kind of when I was young and I started out reading, when I was an apprentice reader, like I first read J.D. Salinger. And do you remember how you felt when you first read Salinger?
Oh, yeah, sure. Catcher in the Rye. It was astounding.
It was astounding. Why?
Because I was absorbed by it. It spoke to me directly.
Yeah, and that's exactly, and so I hadn't had, that's exactly how I felt. It was incredible. It was kind of why, I mean, you know, people are kind of shy about it. It's like the first girl, the first boy everyone dates. And then, like, since everyone dated the same person, people kind of don't want to own up to it.
Right.
But everyone I know, every writer I know had that experience with Salinger. And then it's kind of lonely because you don't have that experience again. I mean, there are other writers you love. I love Nabokov and John Updike and John Cheever and Laurie Moore. But you never quite have that experience again. And it was an explosive thing to start reading David's work in the early 90s. It was, I think I talk about it in the book, it was like opening a magazine because he started out in magazines first. And instead of seeing words, kind of seeing a mirror in there. Mm-hmm. And it was shocking and incredibly exciting. And it was the first time that I'd had that experience really since Salinger.
Mm-hmm. It was this brain voice, but it was not a stream of consciousness, sort of almost gibberish. It was it's well ordered.
Oh, no, it's incredibly fun. I mean, there's nothing... I mean, the thing about David, which was so shocking to everyone and why everyone got so thrilled about his work, was that it's incredibly fun. When there's a very famous piece he wrote that's incredibly funny, and I encourage people to go find it. If you go to the Harper's website and just search David Foster Wallace, the piece there is called Shipping Out. It's a piece he wrote about not the most promising subject. He was going to spend 7 days on a cruise ship. And it's just the most fun. It's the funniest and the most fun thing I've read in the last 15 years. And I remember that when it came out, the editor of Harper's read it and was thrilled by it. And he said, we knew immediately that we had pure cocaine on our hands. That's how much fun it is to read. That's how much fun David is to read.
When you were with him in 1996, 5 days on the last leg of this book tour, for Infinite Jest, you mentioned he was not entirely comfortable with you writing a profile on him. In fact, he said to you, you write this in the book, you're going to be able to shape this essentially how you want, and that to me is extremely disturbing.
God, he's funny, isn't he? Yeah, it was that was what was one of the incredibly exciting things about doing the book this way is he knew that when you write about somebody, when you write a biography or a profile, that it's kind of the writer's impressions of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And I had these, you know, I had these tapes of having been with them for 5 days, and we did every, you know, we were going to Denny's, we were getting lost on the road, we were losing our gas cap at the Exxon, we were at Mall of America in Minneapolis, and it was like, here's exactly what this guy who's a genius. Here's exactly what it's like to actually be with him. This is the kinds of things he notices. These are the kind of things he talks about. And rather than kind of writing my impression of it, the idea, and what I thought was really wonderful about doing the book, was saying, here, now you as the reader get to spend the exact same time I got to spend with him. And that to me was just an incredibly exciting thing. It's kind of, you know, like if you're a Hemingway fan or a Fitzgerald fan, if you read a biography, you kind of hear what they're like, but you don't get to go fishing with Hemingway, or you don't get to go to a dinner party with Fitzgerald. But I thought what was great about this book, and kind of responding to what David had said when he said it made him disturbed kind of to think so of someone else managing the impression of him, was saying, look, here is the entire conversation we had. Here's everything we saw and talked about and everything that we experienced on the road for 5 days.
This is not a conventional biography form. You don't take a central role as a narrator in the book, except the preface, the afterword, which is actually at the beginning of the book. It is essentially a transcript of the conversations, almost all the conversations you had with Wallace in these 5 days. Why did you choose this form and not a more conventional biographical form of narration?
Well, I think David is, well, first off, a simple thing. He's so incredibly funny, and he's so incredibly alive that writing it any other way, you'd have to lose stuff. I mean, you'd have to decide, okay, do you quote this thing, do you quote that thing? But beyond just the incredible pleasure I have in reading him, and that I hope readers take in reading him too, is that it's an amazing thing. It was an incredible thing to have on paper. Here's exactly what it was like to spend time with David Foster Wallace. And I know that as a fan of his and as someone who just loves reading about writers and who just loves reading, that was an incredibly unique experience to offer. And it's one that I would have wanted to have as a reader. So I kind of wanted to make the book that I knew I would enjoy myself.
Rolling Stone contributing editor David Lipsky with me, his new biography of author David Foster Wallace, titled Although, of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace, was just published released last week, number 16 on the New York Times bestselling list. David Lipsky will be speaking at the Des Moines Public Library on Monday evening. Wallace, a brilliant writer, MacArthur genius, committed suicide in 2008. David Foster Wallace, you talked about awareness in the writing. He was very worried about his celebrity and how that would change him, make him too self-aware, and the effect that would have on his craft. Explain how he thought fame would change him and how it, in fact, did.
Well, he's great. We've all seen, because of movies and TV, we've all seen versions of every scene we're likely to act out in our lives. We've seen, you know, reunions with our parents or arguments with our kids or good times or bad times with our wives or girlfriends or boyfriends or husbands. And so it kind of makes you watch yourself from a distance anyway. And that's kind of part of the brain voice that David's work gives us. And I think it's kind of why the New York Times called him the best mind of his generation, was he gets all the comedy, you know, all the slight pain and the great comedy of being that self-aware. But David is incredibly awake. He's the most awake person I've ever been around. And so he was afraid of having an extra level of self-awareness put on top of that. And so what he said this great thing. He said that there's good self-consciousness, or there's being raped by psychic Bedouin self-consciousness. And he was afraid that the thinking about himself as a famous writer would lead to those kind of unfortunate desert encounters.
Now, you had a chance to observe him as he was in the throngs of fans on this book tour. How did he behave then?
He was faultlessly polite. I mean, he's incredibly charming. It was very fun. It was really fun to write about a writer because, you know, I've always been on the other side of a signing line, you know, when you're waiting and there's some writer you love and they're writing their autograph and they're writing a little message to you. And it was really fun to have that scene from the other side. He was totally charming. You know, he liked to draw a smiley face under his signature, and people didn't know what it was, and he'd explain, no, that's not a computer, that's a smiley face, but I can put liquid paper on it, it's your book. And just incredibly charming.
Now, to recount quickly, Wallace had just published a 1,000-page novel, received international acclaim for this book. He received the MacArthur Genius Award. He accepted later a special chair to teach writing at a college in California. He married. He published another book. At the age of 46 in 2008, David Foster Wallace hanged himself. What were the circumstances that led to this suicide?
Well, he had been on antidepressants, on the generation of antidepressants, just before things like Prozac and Zoloft, for about 20 years. And about a year and a half before he died, one of the hard things about the drug he was on, a drug called Nardole, was that you couldn't eat certain foods, but sometimes the ingredients that were on, like, the forbidden list would turn up in other things. So he was at a Persian restaurant, ate something, got kind of sick, went to the hospital, and the doctors, when they found out he was on Nardole, they were kind of surprised. It was kind of like like a drug from like the pre-modern era, like from the antenna TV era. And so they said, look, there are great new drugs. You should get off that drug and get on a new one. And so he tried it. But I talked to a doctor at Harvard Medical School about this. The problem, if you've been long-term on a chemical agent for depression, is that other chemical agents might not work as well, and then the one that you were using before is no longer effective if you go back. And so for a year, he tried other drugs. None of them worked. He couldn't sleep. He lost about 70 pounds. Then after a year, they put him back on the Nardole, and just as that doctor from Harvard was talking about, it no longer worked, and he just kind of, you know, after a year like that, he just couldn't go on anymore, and he hanged himself. So it's a terrible medical story.
The cover of your book shows Wallace with one of his big dogs in his lap, as a matter of fact. I'm not sure if that's a black lab.
That's a black lab called Jeeves.
Jeeves. And in the afterword of the book, you quote his sister pondering what his last moments were like before he hanged himself. You quote her as saying, "David and his dogs, and it's dark. I'm sure he kissed them on the mouth and told them he was sorry." What an image. What does that tell you about David Foster Wallace?
And also about his family. It shows you, how warm and kind he was as a person, and how warm and kind his family is. I remember when Amy Wallace told me that on the phone when we were talking a few days after David had died. In the book, you know, and I remember just from being with him, I mean, he's just, you know, he loves those dogs, and it was just a very hard image to think about.
How did your reflection on those 5 days spent with Wallace, all that he had shared with you, change after his death?
Well, it changed in an important way, because after he died, people began to think of him as someone who had always been sort of grim and depressive. And it's not that. I mean, the real thing, the way it felt to me being around him was, sorry to use a phrase like this, but it was like a celebration of life. He was totally awake. There's early in the book, I quote another friend of his, from Harper's Magazine, who said the great thing is that he's using 6.5 senses at once, so when you're around him, you got to see more, because he shared that with you. I mean, he was incredibly funny. I mean, the book is, aside from anything else, it's, for me as a reader, I can't speak for anyone else, but it's incredibly funny because he's so amazingly funny. I mean, we checked into a hotel in Minneapolis, and the desk clerk said, "You know, Mr. Lipsky, you have, you know, your room has two twins." And David said, "Yes, Anita and Consuela." You know, he's incredibly, incredibly fast, incredibly, incredibly funny. And so for me, when you get to spend time, you know, when you get to spend time with someone who's that charming and that great, and then people begin talking about them as if they've only been kind of a sad figure, you want to do what you can to say, no, here's what he was like. He was just the most alive person I've ever been with, who also, you know, as his sister said, unfortunately suffered from depression.
What does his brilliance, do you think, have to do with his struggle with depression? Are the two tied some way?
You know, I don't think they are. I think that the depression is just was a chemical thing that was unrelated. He just happened to be. I mean, his parents are both incredibly charming people and incredibly smart. I mean, sometimes you meet people and you meet their parents either before or after, you don't quite see how they came out. David's a brilliant writer, and he's also an incredible thinker. And his father, as you might imagine, he's a great writer too. His father is a philosophy. His father's a philosophy professor, and his mother teaches writing. So I think that he got both those things, and then somehow in the mix he also developed this depression. But I don't think that they're connected at all. I think it's just, had he stayed on the Nordahl, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
One review of your book was written by one of Wallace's close colleagues, Kathleen Fitzpatrick. She said that David Foster Wallace in the book was not the one she knew. It was him putting on an act.
Well, actually, she says two things. I thought that was a great piece that Professor Fitzpatrick wrote. She said that in the beginning, and I think it's a fun part of the book, he's seeing me as representative from Rolling Stone, and because he can read people and situations really well, he's talking about things that I think he imagines the Rolling Stone reader would want to hear about, particularly his wanting to meet women on the tour.
A sexed-up version of himself he presented.
That was very charming. And, his hope that he would meet women. He said this great thing. He says these women, they kind of slither up to you, at readings. And you don't want to say to them, I'd love to meet you. You want them to say, hi, I really like you. Where can we go have a drink or something like that? But then what she said also, which I thought was fascinating, was that when he relaxes and just starts speaking kind of as himself, that it wasn't quite the person that she had known, 10 years later when he was teaching. He was such a gifted writer, they made a special chair for him at Pomona College in California. And he wasn't quite the social person that she'd gotten to know during the years they were colleagues there, which I thought was fascinating. I mean, that's, again, is one of the great things about doing the book this way, is saying, here's what this incredible person was like as they were living their lives.
Wallace didn't like to call himself a writer, you write, because he didn't like, because he didn't like being mistaken for that type of person. What is the type of person he didn't want to be as a writer?
I was laughing because he said, the people at Eastern colleges, the people, the kids who wear berets and they're politically correct and they're very sensitive. And he said, one reason I still don't like to call myself a writer is I don't ever want to be mistaken for that kind of person.
Right. And tell us, remind us what he looked like when he walked into the room, a big guy.
He's a big guy. It was like he looked like somebody who was going to invite you to play hacky sack with him. And if you said no, there was some possibility he'd beat you up. he looked on purpose, kind of. He didn't, there's a thing about, his writing is incredibly vital. It's the most fun and the most direct and the most real-seeming writing I've read really since Hemingway or Salinger. And I think he felt that writing, which meant a huge amount to him in his life, had this risk, in the face of the much more popular and better-dressed mediums of TV and movies, much more popular and cool to be around, that it might just seem kind of refined. It would be like the chess club of culture, the people in the basement who were kind of looked a little skinnier and looked a little, unfortunately, well put together. And he wanted to say, no, this is part of our lives in the same way that having long hair is part of your life, or not shaving is part of your life, or wearing big boots is part of your life. I thought it was great. I thought it was a lovely sort of aesthetic slash style point that he was making. Although I think for him, his sister just jokes, he loved to wear, and it's in the book, he just loved to wear things that were, really comfortable cotton. And so whenever he'd visit his sister, he would go through her drawers he'd go through her clothing drawers for like the best t-shirts. And he said even the most girly t-shirts he'd wear if he loved the weave.
David Foster Wallace told you that he thought books existed to stop you from feeling lonely.
Yeah, it was great. I'd never thought about that way, but it's exactly right. What he said is that just to know that there's another consciousness that experiences the world the way you do makes the world seem immediately better. It makes the world seem warmer and more populated. And that is what he's trying to do with everything he writes.
And then that going back to your J.D. Salinger comment, when we first experienced that, how many of us didn't feel lonely in a certain way?
No, it's a great thing. I mean, you feel suddenly, my God, that's exactly the experience I've had. And that's the weird thing of being a person. It's one of the things he writes about and that he talks about so much in the book, is that even if we're around other people all the time, we are isolated in this, in this big kind of brain socket, and you don't really know if anyone else is experiencing things even close to the way that you do, and you don't get any kind of instruction manual, so you can't know if you're experiencing life, you know, to specifications. You know, your mileage may vary or something.
David Lipsky, we have about a minute or so left. Sure. If you could relive one moment with David Foster Wallace from those 5 days in 1996, would you choose a moment for us and explain it?
Yeah, it's the last, really pretty much. I mean, I would relive him joking about having had a tremendous crush on Margaret Thatcher and wanting her to cover his hand with hers and tell him that she'd enjoyed something he said. But really, he was talking about how people should live, and it's the last thing he says to me in the book. He said, look, here's what I think. If you can think of times in your life that you've treated people with extraordinary decency and love and pure uninterested concern just because they were valuable as human beings, the ability to do that with ourselves, to treat ourselves the way we would treat a really good, precious friend or a tiny child of ours that we absolutely loved more than life itself. And I think it's probably possible to achieve that. I think part of the job we're here for is to learn how to do it. I know that sounds a little pious. That was just about the last thing he said, and it was incredibly moving, and it's something that I've tried to do since being with him.
David Lipsky, that's a wonderful way to end this conversation. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, Ben, it was great to be on. Thank you for having me, and thank you for giving me a chance to talk about David Wallace.
Rolling Stone contributing editor David Lipsky, his new biography of the author David Foster Wallace, titled Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace, has just been published. David Lipsky will speak in Des Moines at the Maine Public Library on Monday evening, I believe beginning at 7 p.m. as part of the Avid series. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, Jeff Schmidt, and Alex Hoyer, our producer assistant today, Lindsay Moon, and Rosalind Sixby. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.